Welcome to Keeping It Green, a podcast for ornamental plant professionals and enthusiasts, with hosts Margaret Pickoff and Tim Abbey.
Hello, and welcome to Keeping It Green, a podcast from Penn State Extension for ornamental plant professionals and enthusiasts. I'm one of your hosts, Margaret Pickoff. I'm a horticulture educator with Penn State Extension, and on each episode, I'm joined by my colleagues on the Green Industry team as co-hosts. On today's episode, my co-host is Sandy Feather. Hi, Sandy.
Hey, Margaret, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Good, good. On today's episode, we'll be joined by Michelle Catania from Morton Arboretum. Before we get to our interview with Michelle, we will start out with a little check-in about what's going on in our landscape. I am in eastern Pennsylvania in the Philly area. Sandy, you're in western Pennsylvania in the Pittsburgh area. So what are you seeing at this time of year?
Well, we had an awful lot of rain these last couple of days. So we have like major highways closed due to flooding. And as we were having sleet and hail storms yesterday. So
I think our
plants that have decided to bloom and, you know, the daffodils and stuff were like, I think we came up too early.
Yeah. I mean, we had kind of a pretty big warm spell a couple weeks ago. The temperatures got really high. It was feeling very springy, almost summery.
Right.
And then we kind of launched into this really rainy spell. And I mean, I don't know about you. Our temperatures really dipped towards the end of this week. I know up north they were getting a lot of snow.
And so
it's kind of all over the place. I wonder how the plants are faring, but this is kind of like what we've seen in the last couple of springs are just these huge swings in temperature and lots and lots of rain here.
Fortunately, the daffodils and stuff seem fine. They're a little beat down by all the rain at this point, but they didn't really get hurt by the cold weather. The poor magnolias, though, they
it's
the
so
saucer
sad,
magnolias
isn't it?
got so fried. It's sad.
Yeah, I mean, we wait so long for those blossoms to open up and just to see them turn brown is so sad. Yeah,
as a
well,
matter
it
of fact,
happens.
I was, you know, for our around the state, I was walking up to a neighbor's tree to take a picture of the fried magnolia flowers for the around the state for Tom, and it started to hail. You know, the sun was shining. I walked up to the neighbor's house, and just as I'm about to take a picture, the sky got black, black, black. You could hardly see the flowers, you know, in my camera. And I was like, okay. And then it started to hail. So I just came home.
Oh my goodness.
Whatever.
That's always
I'll
so
get
crazy.
This another day.
Yeah. When hail happens, it's always like a surprise and like out, it feels like it's out of nowhere. It's a very strange weather
Fortunately, it was
condition.
little hail. It wasn't, you know, like the softball sized thing you see on the news that damages people's homes and cars and really does a number on plants. So
yeah.
I guess
Wow.
I'm glad it was little hail.
Yes. I'm glad for your sake that it was as well. Great. Well, it's nice to see you, Sandy, and nice to catch up with you. So let's bring on our guest for today, Michelle Catania. She is a green industry outreach coordinator for Morton Arboretum in Illinois, which is about 30 minutes west of Chicago, from what I understand. And so we're so excited. I think that our work kind of aligns in a lot of ways with us in Extension and you working for the Arboretum. So really excited to hear more about it. So welcome, Michelle.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah. So can you start out by just telling us about your role as Green Industry Outreach Coordinator for Morton?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting position. It was created for me. So I've been at the Arboretum for almost 15 years. And I spent the first 10 years as a soil science research assistant. And I did a lot with two different PIs, one being Bryant Scherenbrock, who is actually an urban soil scientist up at Stevens Point in Wisconsin. So when I started working for him, I had a crash course in urban soils and how to improve them for improvements to urban trees. So throughout that training I received with him, there was a natural progression to get into the green industry. Once he left, I started working more doing outreach. And then I started asking questions, and I was like, we need to do more with green industry professionals. And they were like, well, how about we just create a role for you? So that's what happened. It was kind of a very organic evolution of how I started to where I am. So yeah, it was, we're recognizing as an institution that we're at a really sweet spot working with for profit as well as the growers, and we have such a strong educational output that creating this role to kind of intercept issues and do more trainings and outreach, it's working out well.
And Morton Arboretum has done a lot of great plant introductions over the years.
That is correct, right? With our we I know we're very happy with our elms that we've put back out into the environment. So
Nice
yes.
viburnums. Yep.
Yeah, can you actually, to give us some context, can you tell us a little more about Morton Arboretum just as an institution?
Yeah, no, it's actually a really neat story. So we have all heard of the Morton Salt Company. That was headquartered in Chicago. It still is. And the son of the founder, Joy Morton, was actually just going for a leisurely drive in the far distant country from Chicago, right? He was out in the, in the farm country and found this little area that had some nice rolling hills, which is atypical of Chicago. So when he saw, had his driver pull over and he just stopped and was looking at the landscape, and it was mostly agriculture with some patches of forest, and he saw a small little fire, went over, started looking at it, and extinguished it, and pretty much at that point decided he wanted to purchase that land. So he purchased the land with the intention of having like a retreat for his family to come out of city, as well as to, they always his father, so the founder of Morton Salt actually founded Arbor Day Foundation. So trees run really deep in the Morton family. So what he wanted to do to honor his family and the Morton Salt Company was start a facility that essentially he started growing trees on with the intent of using that to determine what trees would do best in like plantation type growing as well as urban settings. So the Arboretum actually has a really rich history of, there's about 35, they're called forestry plots at the Arboretum, and they're over 100 years old.
That's
So we have really neat populations of the same tree grown in like a plantation setting. So you just see these rows of trees, and they're 100 years old. And it's really,
amazing.
it is. It's a really neat, actually, common garden experiment that all of our researchers are, peeling all the layers back and looking at it. So it worked out well. In hindsight, what he did for these researchers there today is an amazing gift.
Really is. And I
Right.
had no idea about the Arbor Day Foundation.
Yeah, no, it's a
Mentioned
really,
that.
I mean, definitely a really neat story. So, that's their family ties are in Nebraska, and that's where Arbor Day Foundation is actually found, the headquarters are. But yeah, we align a lot with them.
I'm on my community shade tree commission, and we are at Tree City, USA.
That's great. That's great to hear. I know we try to promote that as much as possible. So
Yeah,
yeah, Arboretum has a lot of history in our area as well. So they've done, it's a nice oasis. It's about 1,800 acres in the middle of like urban sprawl. So it's a wonderful place to just retreat from all of that.
It sounds
Yeah.
really great.
Yeah.
I hope it's on my bucket list to come visit you.
Please do. Please do.
And so now, so there is a research component, obviously, that you're involved with, but you also have visitors who are homeowners or people just interested in plants. Do you have an idea of like what the visitorship is each year, or like who comes to see you? Is it Chicagoans? Is it folks from outside the state?
Right. So we hit pretty high numbers annually. I think they were looking at like, 750,000 visitors a year. And then pre-COVID, we received some of the first Dutch trolls in America. So we had five of those Dombo trolls growing installed at the Arboretum. Are you familiar with the troll project?
No, very
Oh, maybe something to
intriguing.
look into. Okay, so he's a Danish artist, and he builds huge, larger than life wooden trolls out of recycled materials. So that in and once we got our five trolls installed, we started seeing more. We started tipping over 1 million visitors a year.
Oh, wow.
Whoa, that's a
And the
huge draw.
visitors are families and people that want, because we have a very strong visitor center complex, and we have this amazing children's garden that even as an adult you would get lost in and enjoy every part of it. It has that naturescape feel to it. So it's a beautiful landscape garden setting that you inadvertently learn things in. From a child's viewpoint, but no, between the trolls and the visitor center complex, we get a lot of visitors that just use us as a nice oasis, a place to go, have, just tap out, get a cup of coffee, and learn something. Like that's sitting in the shade of a tree and just enjoying that is. But then you can escape that and go into the forest, and it's you can have the best of both worlds. Or we have this beautiful restored prairie there if you want to, go get those scents. When a prairie on like a 95-degree day just smells different, and it's just amazing to see that and feel it and hear it. So yeah, there's a lot of different opportunities there.
Yeah, that prairie ecosystem is so special and obviously was, dominant in a huge part of the country a long time ago before agriculture kind of took over. But yeah, that's cool that you have that as well for people to experience who might not have access to that kind of special ecosystem, especially if they're in cities or other like suburban areas. That's really nice.
Right.
Yeah, so I'm curious about your path to where you are. You talked a little bit about starting at the Arboretum, doing urban soil research. How did you get interested in that world? Were you a gardener or plant person before that, or someone interested in the urban environment?
Right. So no, I didn't really even consider that to be a career choice. So I have a bachelor's in biology of persistent plant science, and I wasn't really satisfied with what that meant or what I could do with it. And then I have a master's in geography, and I was looking at forest ecology. And I still wasn't satisfied with that and knew there was something more that would give me that sense of like actually doing something of value. And once I saw this job at the Arboretum, the job posting required a bachelor's in biology. They wanted somebody with some deep labs experience because a lot of soil science is just working in a lab and doing extraction. So that was how I got in the door. Obviously, love of trees, nature, and the ability to do some basic wet chemistry science in a lab with training, right? Well, then everything opened up and it was amazing because studying trees in the urban environment is, that's where we live. Like I can study a tree in Brazil, but that's not where that doesn't impact me in my daily life. So I think that that was the neatest bow to tie around that is knowing that what I started working towards were trees where we live. And then you start to be exposed to the pressure. Everybody, I ruin a lot of people's day by showing them an ugly tree that they did not know was an ugly tree. So, you get this training and you're like, okay, I can help. I can intercept this. I can fix this. So that's kind of where we evolved into this. But a lot of, 5, 10 years of, running soil samples and just understanding that really helped translate it to the urban environment. So I spend a lot of time studying natural soils. So I have a really good baseline of what the soil should look like. Well, then after you're done compacting them and beating them up in the urban environment, this is what I tell people. I'm like, go into a forest, dig a hole, put your head in it, see what's there, see what a tree naturally wants to live in. Do the same post-construction. Tell me the differences and what can you do to revert that? So, that's kind of where I don't know if, I think I kind of went around the answer to your question.
Well, it's your background and how you got here is pretty interesting. We just I belong to the Pendel chapter of ISA, and we just had our annual shade tree symposium, and Nina Basic was our keynote speaker. And I was looking at your CV and see that you co-authored a paper with her. And so I'm sure you're familiar with her scoop and dump techniques for trying to improve soil for urban tree survival.
Right, no, that's an amazing ability if the tree's not there, right?
Yeah,
So if the
right.
tree is
But when the
there,
tree's already there.
you can't necessarily start tearing it apart, which is really why. So the work that we studied under Bryant Schierenbrock was, let's pretend the tree's already there, right?
Okay.
Because so many homeowners will come in and they'll get a new build, right? Especially in where we are in the western suburbs of Chicago, we were seeing, like, 5-year-old subdivisions. Well, how long does it take for an urban tree to start failing? 3 to 5 years. So then, we were coming in at that and we're like, well, what can we do to try to change the trajectory of this tree's longevity? So surface treatments was what we pretty much
Right,
studied.
right.
And that was a really neat way, and it was attainable by anybody. You don't need to go rent a backhoe. You just need to get some, shovels, a rake, and some materials to put down.
Right,
We
right.
t so that was a lot of the work that we did, was looking at amendments, so at surface amendments, and how they impact the trees over time, and soil, obviously.
Right. Did you do any work with biochar?
We started by when Schierenbrock was leaving, we started dabbling with biochar, and then when the new soils ecologist came in, she's done some work with biochar. But yeah, we actually just had a paper come out at the end of last year, looking at some integrating biochar within the soil using the air spading method.
Okay.
We were just the researchers on it. We did not do the actual air spading. We partnered with Bartlett.
Okay.
But no, that's it. I mean, I you know it has there's a lot of there's kind of a double-edged sword with that material. We like it, but at the same time, we cautiously talk about it.
Okay.
We need the research to catch up with it. I think it has potential, it's tremendous potential. But we don't want to say, oh, here it is, do this. This will fix all of your problems.
Yeah, because
Right.
we all know there's no easy answer.
Yeah, we're all suspicious of the silver bullet, I think.
Absolutely.
I do want to ask about Chicago as an urban place that has trees, because I'm sure that those urban trees suffer a lot of the same stressors that trees in all cities do, or suburban areas. I live in South Philly, and I mean a big problem here is we don't have enough trees. We could use more trees, but it's a stressful environment. Are there any particular, stressors that maybe are unique to Chicago, or is it like a post-industrial setting? Is there constant development? Is there something about the soil that's, a little bit different, or are these trees kind of suffering the same way that most trees in other urban areas would?
Yeah, that's a pretty complex question. So going back earlier, we were talking about prairies. Well, we're actually a prairie state. So if you
Yeah.
look at the fingerprint of the soils, you're going to see a lot of the soils are mostly prairie soils. So now we're kind of like in an environment where we're like, well, you're a tree and you're going to go here, right? So prairie soils tend to have, our soils here are actually a very high clay content. We have a rich history of glaciation that came down, and we just have, I mean, in some areas you have 40% clay. So now you have a area that's been, degraded, compacted, high clay, and we're trying to put upland tree species in there.
How about the pH? What's your
The pH is, we're around neutral. We're doing
Okay.
good.
Okay.
Our base material is pretty deep. We have really thick, deep soils. You could dig down. I'm closer to the lake, to Lake Michigan, and we have higher clay, more of that. When you it's called blue clay. It has, you could make, like, you can dig it out of the ground and form a pot out of it and sit it there, and it'll be there forever. It depends on where you are. If you're along like a river, you're going to get different soils. But some of the biggest challenges in the city proper themselves is, I think it was in the late 1850s, most of Chicago burnt to the ground.
Right.
And all that material.
Mrs. O'Leary's cow.
Yep, exactly. And most of that material had to go somewhere. So they used it to build part of the lake out. And then they used it a lot in street setting. So when I've heard stories of a group of tree, it's called tree keepers, and they've pulled boat anchors out of tree pits. So all that
Whoa.
rubble is below ground, right? They just
Okay.
kind of like
Oh,
forgot about it. Let's
wow.
just like do this and then forget about it. So it's an interesting patchwork of when you're in the, in the city where it's mostly concrete and you get the 3x3 cutouts for trees, you could have such high variability between one and another because it depends on what that house at that time was built out of. And then filled
Interesting.
in, where they can, sometimes you'll see it's full sand. Well, some company at some point in time just then was like, we'll just fix it by dumping a few yards of sand in there.
And then they
So,
made concrete. Yes, thank you.
yeah.
So how do you then, I mean, that this is like such an interesting set of challenges. Like, how do you then make recommendations to the industry when there's so much variability? And I feel like in urban settings, the desire is to be like, this is a tree that is like bulletproof and we're going to put it everywhere. And
So then
it's
we
like,
have a
no, that's usually not a good idea.
monoculture.
How do you get away from that,
Mindset.
that sort of mindset where it's like we have these three species that are just never going to die and we're going to put them everywhere, where we know that that's not a great strategy in a lot of ways for planting in any setting. Like how do you make those recommendations?
Right. So obviously, with a strong soils background, I do a lot with arborists and I try to increase their toolbox and their toolkits by being like, here's a soil probe. Here's an 18-inch Oakfield soil probe for and see it, smell it, touch it, feel it. If you were a root, can you grow through it? If you can imagine water trying to flow through it. So the tra understanding the variability is there. Like, okay, it's there. Step one, I know there's going to be variability and probably high clay in your soil. So now let's actually look about 18 inches deep into it in this little window that we can pull out with this soil probe. And so the training on learning how to match the best tree to the best site is obviously the key. That way we can find very high value sites and put a more sensitive tree there. And then when you have these sites that are like with anchors and sand and
Anchors.
bricks, go ahead, give that an elm, right? Let's do that. Let's put that tough tree there. But we obviously came across, had, something bite us really hard with that emerald ash borer rolled through and took out like a majority of our urban trees. So the professionals have learned that they need to increase their palate. And I'm a firm believer that training them to look at the soil first and then match the tree to that. So Sharon Brock and a bunch of other researchers developed this, it's called the RACI, Rapid Urban Site Index. So what we were able to do is I spent 3 summers going to multi different age subdivisions that we knew when they were installed and we knew when the trees were installed. And we did a bunch of soil sampling and tree measurements. And he was able to build a model off of that. And all the parameters we measured, he was able to pull out the ones that were like most important. pH was one of them. Time of disturbance was one of them. So we can take this RACI model and kind of hopefully overlap it to more real world situations and just give an understanding for what a practitioner should look at to help further drive that tree matching species to the site. That was started by actually some folks in Ohio. They were
Okay.
an arborist in Ohio, then approached Brian Schoenbrock at a conference, was like, hey, we've been doing this thing where we poke the soil with a stick. What do you think? So, calibrating a stick and seeing how what the penetration resistance is absolutely fantastic. Like you can do a lot with it. So I do encourage people to poke things with a stick. And I feel that that is a really good method of just, like I said, you go to a tree in a natural setting, you calibrate yourself to that. Then when you're out in the urban environment, you say, well, okay, this late successional upland tree wants to grow here, but we just had a, a backhoe 5 minutes ago here. So what do we do to fix it? And this pulls in that scoop and dump method or the surface treatment. Just, we can, if we can destroy it, we can fix it. And I'm a firm believer in that especially in these post-construction environments, the equipment is actually there. The same equipment that compacted the soil is the same equipment that can save the soil.
I'm not familiar with the scoop and dump method. Can you describe what that is?
Yeah, so I've never personally done research on it, but I like we were talking, Nina Bassick and Susan Day, they're both very strong in this method. So what you have is this post-construction environment, topsoil was stripped off, subsoil was compacted. Traditional landscaping then would be to put 2 to 3 inches of topsoil back on, drill some holes, plant some trees, walk away. What this does is it intercepts that and it says, all right, what we're going to do is we're going to take a backhoe and we're going to tell the operator, here's your day to shine. So this is the planting area we're working on. Do multiple lifts. So rip open the compacted subsoil and just kind of tear it open. Then bring in some truckloads of quality topsoil and some compost and start just flipping that in. And so this machine operator is essentially playing in a big sandbox and creating deep, right. And it's, I mean, to them, this is like they're like
Finally.
been trained for all these years. So you're making deep veins of this compost and organic additions to this otherwise compacted area. The key to what Susan Day has learned is the key to the scoop and dump method is you have to immediately install your tree. Because the tree, when you walk away, then you start nurturing that tree in the below ground, the exploration of roots within those veins is where you're going to keep compaction from happening. Because a lot of times we see recompaction happen. So it's essentially taking sponges and putting it into this compacted area and then growing a tree in it. I
Yeah,
mean,
sounds I mean I we do that on a smaller scale, planting shrubs and things into soils that are not great, and you have to work the soil around where the root zone's going to be and put some nice compost in there. So it makes sense that, on a larger scale, you can use a backhoe and do some of that as well. Well, that's super interesting. I'm also curious. So you've talked a little bit about your work directly with the industry, and obviously, so we are also green industry educators, and so a lot of our job is to take, scientific information that's current and relevant and kind of sometimes translate it in a way that the industry can grasp and integrate into their work. And so as an educator, I'm curious how like what your strategy is for doing that. You're obviously someone with a really deep scientific knowledge. How do you translate that into concepts that are easy to understand for non-scientists and also are more likely to be to result in the adoption of some of these practices with the industry?
That's exactly right. So getting them to actually jump on board is the challenge. So yeah, the last thing I want to talk to anybody about is like an R squared value or, and it's also because I just don't want to deal with R squared values. So it's a natural progression. Like I think just like you said, repackaging that information and making it attainable and understandable and something that is a target for people to work towards, which is why when you do applied science and applied research, I think it's very natural for it to make sense to try and repackage it to tell the actual boots on the ground, because that's why we're doing this stuff. It's for them, it's not for us. It's to help them improve the, at the end of the day, we want higher forest canopy cover, right? Well, how are we going to get that? We're going to get that by the folks that are actually doing the tree installations and maintenance. So I think just having a lot of practice and, my first experience in the green industry for a large scale talk, I walked into an auditorium at the Shade Tree Short Course up in Minnesota, and there was like 1,000 people in the room. I was like, okay, here we go. Here we go. And then I think it just, you kind of have like that out of body experience where you're just talking and you read them and you see what they want and what worked well. And then I think just over time, even when I'm showing a graphic or a table that has a lot of data points, I'm like, all right, ignoring everything else. All you need to see is this. And these are different. They show they're different. That's the science. Moving on. And then I tell them why that's important and how it can integrate to their workload. So I am known as the crazy soil lady in like the Illinois arborist community, no doubt. I appreciate that. So, allowing that, that passion and that kind of, you geek out for a few minutes in front of them, and then they really see that she's just excited and she just really wants to talk about soil aggregates. And we're going to listen about soil aggregates for a while. And then I've had them come up to me. I've had people come up to me and they're like, I saw you talk a few years ago and you planted a seed in my head. And now I have a soil probe. And I didn't know what to do with it at first. And now I tell everybody they need a soil probe. Right. And so just kind of sharing what the tools that are done in other fields, you can easily integrate it into, your work load. And then I'm also like, so you go to a homeowner, right? And you show up with a soil probe, you're gonna look pretty cool. And you look like you're the guy for the job,
Yeah, I mean, I think that concept of like allowing people to see with their own eyes what you're talking about, and I've seen a lot of auditoriums filled with people who just had lunch, and then the speaker is showing a bunch of graphs and tables and numbers, and I think that there is definitely an art to, because that's all so important. That information is the backing for what we, recommend. But kind of piecing out like what is the key information here, and how can you actually see it and experience it, so that it clicks and it turns into, yeah, it turns into a practice that you actually do rather than something that like, oh, like the extension lady told me to do this, but or this crazy soil lady told me to do this.
Right.
So I'm all on board with that. I think everyone should have a soil probe with them at all
Yeah.
times.
Hands-on soils workshops are pretty awesome too. So take it back to like that high school level where it's like, all right, guys, we're going to get our hands dirty. We're going to do things. We're going to mush stuff. We're going to smell it. We're going to add water to it. We're going to stir it in beakers. And they just are, I mean, to them, it's this experience that they've never had. And then you're like, well, did you know that we have a very strong agricultural background in this country? And there's this entire like USDA and NRCS that can also support your learning through just like videos online. So I like to share a lot of that information with them. I'm like, you're doing urban farming with woodies. Like the, you know, it's like it's not, it's all built upon that basic, agricultural foundation and how we treat soil. So I enjoy it is it's a my husband's seen me talk once or twice, and he says that yeah, I have a gift talking about complex soil things and being able to make it relatable to somebody that is like, I have 5 minutes at this site. What do I do? But I understand that too. It's not like, oh, we're gonna spend forever here and you're gonna plant one tree all season. I'm like, no, I get it. They need to move. Because I spent 12 years working at a landscape supply company. It's a business. It's a business. We need to feed ourselves. Like, I get it. So
Yeah. Well, and urban environments too. I mean, they're different from an arboretum or a public garden or a place that people are gonna, sit and spend time necessarily. Like there's a real these trees are serving a very important purpose, but it's different than a more manicured garden space. And so the goals of it are kind of different too. Sometimes it's like we just need to increase canopy so that these urban streets are not as hot, or we're having these stormwater issues, or yeah, I think that's such an interesting set of challenges, and it sounds like you're really good at what you do.
I mean, yeah, it's like, at the end of the day, when you're like, okay, I talked for a half an hour, 45 minutes about soils and tree compatibility, and I feel like that something may change from that. Right. There may be some small incremental changes over time that lead to that improvement in forest canopy, and that's pretty much what drives me at the end of the day.
And that's, I know here in Pittsburgh, again, some of our more underserved communities totally lack canopy cover. The emerald ash borer came through here. We had our first find in 2007, and ash trees pretty much got wiped out if they were are not being treated. And one thing that's kind of interesting, we have a rich history of parkland. Like in the city of Pittsburgh, we have major parks. And somebody back in the late 1800s, early 1900s had the foresight to set this land aside. But so we have the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy, which is, manages and oversees this, and they have a pretty strong research component. And one of the things they're looking at are the lingering ash, the green ash trees that despite it all, they're still here, and you can see they've got a level of infestation, but they're not dead. Their crowns look great, so there's some genetic research going on there to see if we can't keep ash trees on our palate, in our palate.
One of our researchers is working on that project as well. So there's some promise there.
I think so too.
Have to find that needle in a haystack.
Yeah, I'm curious about the sort of issues that trees are facing in general in your part of the country. I'm sure that we're seeing some similar disease and insect pest issues. Like for instance, we've been having a really terrible wave of spongy moth come through, especially in central Pennsylvania. That's really impacted a lot of the forested area in the middle of the state. And I wonder, like, are you dealing with spongy moth? And are there other big kind of diseases that are impacting, trees in urban and suburban areas, but also in more of the forested areas in Illinois?
Yeah, no, we have the moth that does impact a lot. I tend to glaze over that stuff, not for any other reason, just for the sake of there's so many issues out there. You kind of have to select one to hyper focus on. But what we're actually seeing is a huge decline in our mature oaks, which is devastating. There's a lot of research going on right now, and it tends to be what they're finding are their roots don't have root hairs, and they're very, very coarse roots. The fine roots are dying back. So we're also having changes in our precipitation patterns here. We're going through extreme droughts. It's hard to detect what's happening when there's an extreme drought. The soils dry up, and then the problems kind of go away. And then it gets really wet and they're compacted and they're clay, like we've talked about. There's thought that we're having that, Phytophthora is there and that these trees are stressed. So now they're becoming susceptible to what's in the environment. And with these fluctuations in soil temperatures and, I mean, excuse me, soil moisture, it's just a hard environment on a forest elder. These are 200-300-year-old trees. This is the landscape. So we're a traditional oak savanna. So these large mature oaks are coming down fast. And it's not just Chicago, it's Midwest. It's Minnesota, Iowa, Indiana. Bob Burr oak blight, I think, is on its way. There's a lot of pressures. There's more things that I think can kill a tree than can save a tree out there.
And
Fortunate.
something that's hit Pennsylvania pretty hard is this beech leaf disease. It's from what all the research has found, it's caused by a foliar nematode, which is just crazy. I mean, I'm used to foliar nematodes in herbaceous plants, but when you're talking about a 80-foot tall beech tree, that seems crazy. But here we are.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we're having a lot of issues with oaks as well, but they're kind of they seem to be more disease related, although it's all connected with I mean, I haven't heard anyone make that connection between precipitation patterns and like the root hairs not developing properly or developing in a different way. But here in eastern Pennsylvania, It's hard to find oak trees, red oaks, that don't have bacterial leaf scorch. And the symptoms are really similar to drought stress, because you see that kind of like marginal leaf browning, and that is, you know, what the leaves would look like when they're under drought stress. And out, I think in Sandy's part of the state, you guys are struggling with oak wilt.
We have oak
a
wilt,
fungal
which is
disease.
Huge.
And so it kind of makes me wonder, like, how all of these things are connected. You know, we have this notion that plants that are more stressed from their environment are more susceptible to these diseases and insect pests, and it's not always well understood, like, what those dynamics are, but it's clear that they're connected. So it's interesting to hear that that's happening out in your area, and I wonder if we're experiencing a lot of that too.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when your environment is stressful, you're going to be stressed then.
Mm-hmm. And you're going to be more likely to get sick.
Yeah, and that's likely what's happening. Whereas if, you know, you can, there are people that are stepping in and, you know, trying to intercept it and reverse the rate, you know, reverse the decline. So what are they doing? They're, you know, doing some injections or doing some soil improvements. They're, you know, trying to alter the drainage. And if that's your tree that you bought that house because of that tree, you're going to, if you have the capabilities and the finances to do it, you're going to dump anything you can into it.
Right, right.
So yeah, there's a lot. I mean, it's a very complex issue and it's going to require complex solutions. And it's a lot of very smart people are trying to work it out right now, at least within what I see in our institution. But, you know, they think they're on the track and they'll chase that. And then they're like, oh, no, never mind. We're going to chase this instead, because they'll start to look at, you know, just, you know, well, they'll hear a lot of anecdotal things as well. And then they're like, all right, let's see what that, you know, what can we find from that? So I know that the plant healthcare leader at the Arboretum does a lot with culturing and trying to identify and isolate issues that are below ground at the interface between the root and the soil. Because, what's, you know, when you have no fine root hairs, it's dying back. Why? Tree roots die back because they're in like an anaerobic environment. They're just too saturated, or there's something biologically creating that. So if you can understand that might, and then that may be the reason why two-lane chestnut borer, all these other things are just now annihilating them.
Right.
They've reduced their buffer.
Yeah. And that's, you know, when I speak about that beech leaf disease, I mean, there's a lot of really smart people, a consortium of universities and arboretums and stuff that are involved in trying to research it. But, you know, funding hasn't really kept up. You know, I don't believe that beech is considered an important timber tree. Mm-hmm. And so the funding hasn't been there to really. It's, I mean, as far as I know, it's a keystone ecological species. It provides mast for a lot of animals. And, you know, it's painful to think that we could lose that tree from our forests.
Yeah. Well, luckily, you know, we have educators trying to make those connections and researchers. It sounds like the, you know, the work you're doing in the urban space is really important, and that the Arboretum itself is doing a lot of really good work trying to get information out there. You're working with industry, and I know that I was doing a little bit of reading about the Gateway to Tree Science installation at the Arboretum, which sounds really great as a way to engage visitors and possibly people who have some land or some trees under their care in understanding some of these dynamics and what they can do to be better tree stewards. So I do see some, I don't want to end on too dark a note, so I do see some hope there. I'm glad that there, you know, there are these conversations happening and there are people like you going out and training the industry in a lot of these concepts. So yeah. It's been interesting to hear about your work. We do, we always end our conversations on a slightly more personal note. And so we've been talking a lot about your work, but we're curious, what you like to do when you're not working.
Right. So I have two children and we like to, as much as we're guided by soccer schedule, we try to hit the road as much as we can and just go on like weekend trips or some adventure. We're actually headed on Sunday. We're going to Indianapolis to see the eclipse, which is
Nice,
Sunday.
nice.
Yeah,
I'll be
so
in. I'll be up near Lake Erie.
yeah, so we're gonna be with like several hundred other thousand people.
Oh yeah, me too.
But no, that's our most recent adventure, so we're excited for that. We did it back in 2017, and it was one of the coolest things I've ever seen. And my kids were
Wow.
too young to kind of remember that, so I was like, "No school for you. So
Yep.
sorry." That's
I bet they're heartbroken.
I know. They do.
Yeah. Did have you gotten your glasses yet? Do you have glasses to watch it? Okay. Cool. Yeah.
But the nice thing about being in totality, once that thing's covered, you just look at it with your bare eyes.
Wow.
It's amazing. It is literally, you could see how civilizations were like,
Oh
can you
gosh, the world
imagine,
is
like,
ending.
imagine when we crawled out of a cave and that happened? They had to think the world was ending,
Absolutely.
you know.
100%.
And
Well,
I understand we're going to be able to see Juniper and I think Venus and possibly a comet
that's incredible. I
during
didn't hear.
totality. Yeah.
I did not hear. That's super cool. I'm so
Wow.
excited.
Amazing. Well, I hope you have an amazing experience with your kids. That sounds great.
Yep.
And so cool that you get some time to see such an amazing and cool phenomenon happen with them and get them a day off of school.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Michelle. This has been a really interesting conversation. It's great to connect with you, and hopefully sometime we Penn Staters can come and visit you out in the Chicago area and see some of the work that you're doing out there.
That would 100%.
that'd be great.
All right. Well, thanks so much. We'll see you soon.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.